The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the Dorman Report. This is Mike Consul with Jeff Dorman. Jeff Dorman is relatively fresh from the I3 conference, Institutional Investing in Infrastructure, in Toronto, Canada. Jeff, it's been a hot subject for years now, and investors obviously have an interest in it, have been piling some money into it. I don't know it's where they want it to be just yet, but what did you hear at the conference? What can you tell our listeners about the current state of infrastructure opportunities?
Well, you know, first of all, maybe a little bit about the conference, if you don't mind, just to talk a little bit about what it's all about.
Sure.
This is a conference that's put together really as an investor conference. All of our conferences are focused on investors because everything we do is investor-focused. And we rebranded it this year. It used to be called Institutional Investing in Infrastructure, which is also the name of our publication. But we rebranded it VIP Infrastructure, which stands for Visions, Insights, and Perspectives. And the turnout is carefully curated to make sure there's a good balance between the investors and investment managers who want to reach them and connect with them. So at this particular event, we had 60 investors, including, you know, investors like CalPERS, CalSTRS, Oregon, New Mexico Educational Retirement System, Utah, the Texas Teachers, just a huge group of really impressive, active investors. And all these guys are actively allocating capital to the space. And then we had 66 investment managers. So it was almost a one-to-one ratio. It was very, very close that way. Another thing that's kind of interesting about our conferences is there are a number of things that make them different. First is we try to create what we call an investor-friendly environment there. And part of the way we do that is by making sure the ratios are comfortable, because otherwise the investors that show up feel like they're overwhelmed by everybody wanting to talk to them and they can't really hold a conversation with the people they want to hold a conversation with. So by balancing the mix, we create something that's more investor-friendly. The other thing we do is we make it a marketing-free environment. There's no marketing. We don't allow any marketing from the podium. We don't allow any side meetings. We don't allow anything that would make people feel uncomfortable. You know, investors are vetting marketing pitches all the time in their offices, and they don't need to come to a conference and be overwhelmed with people that are pitching them. So that's the second thing we do to create kind of an investor-friendly environment. And the third thing we do is we make sure that the program is curated by the investors themselves. So our advisory board that actually helps us establish the agenda is investors only. There's no managers on it. There's no consultants on it. So that ensures that the agenda items they come up with really are topical and focus on things that are important to them. And another thing that's true that goes along with that is there's no pay to play. You can't sponsor one of our events and then get a speaking slot. We're really against that kind of way of operating a conference, because the participants who are paying to come are already paying to come. And they shouldn't be paying to come watch people who have paid to talk to them. That doesn't make any sense. Yes. There's no value to it.
Yeah. And you know, I can't tell you how many times, I mean, people have said to me at our events just that the quality of the content, and of course we attend other events, and I'm not going to name names, of course, but it makes such a difference when somebody's up there because they're an expert and they have a reason to be up there versus that they paid to be up there.
Yeah. And then the final thing that really makes our conferences different is we don't have a lot of speakers. We don't have a lot of panels. Our feeling is that you can Google any topic or any speaker on YouTube and hear what they're going to say. So the real reason to travel hundreds or thousands of miles is not to come listen to people speak. You can do that sitting back in your office if you want to do it on YouTube. Almost everybody has a YouTube video up there. We have several, a hundred up there are of our own. The real reason to come together is to connect with people. And at most conferences, what you have to do in order to connect is leave the conference and go out in the hallway and connect. We've actually built interactivity into our conference programs, so that a lot of what the conference is all about is people talking about important issues that are in roundtable discussion format. So if you come to one of our conferences, you know, you're not only going to have the opportunity to hear from some really intelligent people talking about issues that are really important to the investor community, but you're also going to be able to connect with those investors yourself and engage with them in conversations. So it really is a wonderful place. And if you're an investor, you really get to talk to your peers. You get to talk to investment managers, but not about their programs, but instead issues that are important to you running your program. So it really is a wonderful experience, both for the investors and the investment managers and consultants who attend. So that helps you understand a little bit about what our what makes us different and what the program is really geared to do it. In terms of what we talked about, we always start and open by giving them a little brief overview on what our editorial advisory board for our infrastructure investment publication, what's keeping them up at night. Because that's how we actually create the editorial board agendas. We ask them, what's keeping you up at night? What are the biggest issues that are troubling you right now? What are the biggest challenges you're facing in managing your portfolios? And so when we listen to and hear the topics that they're suggesting through that process, we really get a glimpse into what's driving investment decision-making. And so we set the stage by helping people understand the issues that are on people's minds. And, you know, they were everything from, you know, investment styles to risk-return profiles to what's going on in North America in general in terms of an investment perspective and the number of deals and transactions that are getting done, questions and concerns about the United States and you know, it being so far behind Europe and Canada and Australia and other parts of the world in terms of really embracing the P3 concept and originating the kind of deals that will meet the demand for the kind of deals that investors want to reach. We talked, there was a lot of concern about vehicles and open-end versus closed-end structures, concern about mega funds and whether they're really kind of souring the market by putting too much capital in the hands of too few players. There were concerns about the maturities of some of the closed-end programs and whether there's going to be some event risk that's being introduced into the equation because of those maturities. Concerns about lack of benchmarks and what's being done in the benchmark area, then a concern about integrating ESG and sustainability principles into infrastructure investing, and then just what's going on in the UK and Europe in terms of activity, and then, you know, the impact of technology, machine intelligence, automation, and those kinds of things on the infrastructure space. So lots of stuff going on there.
What about the trends, Jeff, in terms of commitments from institutional investors? Is a trend, I'm assuming the trend is upward from year over year. What kind of growth are we seeing in terms of commitments?
There has been some year-over-year growth. It was starting to grow really well before the global financial crisis. And when the global financial crisis hit, a number of programs blew up. And so a lot of people started to focus on structure, vehicles, leverage, where you are in the risk cycle, what position you're taking. If you wanted to, you know, people talk a lot about capital stacks in real estate. You could think about risk stacks in infrastructure. And, you know, some of the programs that were just too risky and too over-leveraged. That put the brakes on a lot of infrastructure capital flows, particularly amongst U.S. investors who were slow, late to come to the party anyway. But it's picked up tremendously, and we are seeing a lot more capital flows moving from U.S. investors as well as continued capital flows from Canadian and European and Australian and Asian investors. So, you know, yes, activity has picked up dramatically. And one of the things that we actually present at the conference is our fund tracker data on what's going on. So we really get relatively precision numbers about that. It's one of the things that you get at our conference that you don't get elsewhere.
So I ask this question often when talking about infrastructure. A lot of times I don't really get a clear answer on it, maybe because there's so much commingled money. But is there a category of infrastructure, whether geographically or a category like roads and bridges or broadband or seaports and airports, where's the money flowing to in terms of the actual structure or geography?
Well, it was flowing to energy, and energy was one a real hot area. Another area that's attracting a lot of interest is water. Everything from, you know, water resources to wastewater treatment plants and things of that nature. Those are probably the two things that are carrying the most interest. And it's also probably two areas where it's not water, not so much, but energy, where it's easier to deploy capital. It's very difficult to deploy capital in the U.S. into roads, bridges, airports, ports. There's a lot of public issues that need to be addressed, public concerns about, you know, who owns these, you know, strategic resources and community resources. So that's one of the things that somewhat slowed capital flows into those areas. Another thing that slowed it is there's still a healthy municipal bond market out there, and that has been the traditional way in the U.S., unlike in the rest of the world, where capital has been raised to finance these kind of infrastructure programs. So, you know, at least that's what we're seeing now. A lot of interest in alternative energy infrastructure projects and things of that nature as well.
So when you say alternative, are we talking wind and solar? Or are we also talking hydro, tidal energy? Or is it
wind, solar, geothermal, whatever projects are coming to market? Uh-huh. But there's been a lot more coming to market in the solar and wind area than there has been in the geothermal or in the hydroelectric. I mean, I don't know how many years it's been since California's had a new hydroelectric project, but it's been decades. So those are really, really hard because of environmental concerns and what have you to get built.
So let me get your perspective on the whole idea of is the money going towards renewables because people see the need for us to make a change in the energy mix? Or has it actually gotten to the point where, number one, solar and wind is a lot cheaper than it used to be, and secondly, that the returns are there?
I think all of those things are true. Obviously, if your cost goes down, then your return on investment can go up, all right? And the cost of power is set by traditional, not non-traditional sources. So still the majority of power is still generated by hydroelectric, by coal power generation, and to a lesser extent in the United States, but more greater extent in other areas of the world, nuclear. And so that sets the market for energy. And as long as that's relatively high, and the cost of doing alternative investment sources like solar and wind power is coming down, then it makes the profitability of those opportunities a little bit better. But, you know, one of the things we could talk about, Michael, also is what do we talk about at the roundtables? Because it's taken us a number of years to really perfect the whole process of putting together and vetting these roundtables. The problem you have with a roundtable discussion topic is, let's say we decided we were going to talk about water at a roundtable. The problem with that is not everybody sitting around the table is well-versed to be able to connect and talk about that. So we've learned to couch the discussion topics to be things that everybody sitting around the room can talk about. So, for example, one of the topics we talked about was GPLP relationships, you know, and the topic went something like this. Besides basic fundamentals of good GPLP partnerships, they're often talked about, such as trust, transparency, alignment of interest. In order to gain some new insights, let's peel the onion back and dive into some other important aspects that are not addressed as often. So some of the questions that we asked are, what are some of the common challenges regarding developing GPLP partnerships in today's market? And what are the underlying causes of those challenges? And how can these challenges be prevented or insulated to or reduced by both GPs and LPs? So that gives you an idea of the kind of topic that we might be talking about. We also talked about governance, and when you're talking about good governance, one size doesn't fit everybody. So we ask questions like, what are some governance principles that are sticky points for GPs and LPs? And what governance principles are producing unintended consequences today, and explain why? And can these governance principles, the table cited when they're talking, be rewritten to be more effective, or should they simply be dropped? And what are two or to three governance principles that you as a participant have come across that others are using for which you think mass adoption would be in both the GP's and the LP's best interest? So we're really getting the investors and the investment managers to talk to each other about these kinds of issues, and I don't think there's any place else, you know, that where you can have these kind of conversations.
What about the mood? Because investor confidence is so important. Consumer confidence is so important. Investor confidence is so important. What was the general mood of the conference?
Well, it's interesting. When you look at the topics that the editorial board wants to focus on, given it's a different meeting, the editorial board meeting, but if you take a look at those, in the past they've been really more about deploying capital. This meeting is the first time I started to hear people talk about external factors like interest rates, government policy, those kinds of things that have are potentially threatening to put the brakes on both returns and flow of capital. So there seems to be some concerns creeping into the investor community that we may be coming to, up on an inflection point. And I hadn't heard that from this particular kind of group of investors before, so that's kind of interesting.
What about politically? There was so much, I mean, if there's a bipartisan issue, you would think it's infrastructure, and both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump had competing, you know, trillion-dollar infrastructure plans. Mm. It seems that there hasn't been a whole lot of conversation from the government about it, although the Trump administration did roll out a plan. It was kind of a matching type of plan. It wasn't as rich as a lot of people had hoped it would be. Was there a conversation about where the U.S. government is at on this, and even global governments for that matter?
Yeah, there was. There was some discussion about it. You know, the problem with topics like that is there isn't a hell of a lot you can do about it. You can lobby your congressman, you can lobby your senator, you can write to the President of the United States, but you can talk all you want. It's not going to change the environment in which we're operating. And the environment in which we're operating in the United States, compared to the rest of the world, is really not favorable to infrastructure spending, not the way it is in other parts of the world where the government seems to get that it's not an expenditure, it's an investment, and there's a return on investment that will impact the economic health of the whole economy. We don't seem to get that here in the United States. We fight over these expenditures as if we're actually spending money with no return, and that's not the case with infrastructure spending. The other problem you have in the United States is this whole thing I mentioned earlier about the embracing the P3, the
public-private partnership.
Exactly, the public-private partnership concept. People here in the United States are suspicious about who owns their public good assets. And they're always worried about a bunch of things, including their own pocketbook. You know, they're worried if private interests get hold of these assets, they're going to start paying more as ratepayers or as toll payers. And in fact, they probably are. But on the other hand, that might be a little bit more equitable to have the users of these resources helping to contribute to them instead of relying upon the tax base to subsidize these uses. When you're going across, you know, the San Francisco Bay Bridge, every time you pay a toll, you're paying and helping pay for and offset some of the cost of maintaining that bridge system, but not all of it. Some of it comes from you know, tax revenues and highway and road taxes and things of that nature. So nobody wants to pay more higher tolls when they go across that bridge, but also nobody wants the bridge to collapse while they're going across it either.
You know, and it's also and Sheila Hopkins, who I'm going to mention her name again when we talk about returns here in just a moment, she had mentioned, she wrote a column some time ago, probably 2 years ago, about how it's really geographic in the United States as well. I mean, I grew up in upstate New York. I remember my dad throwing coins into the baskets going into New York City all the time. It was kind of second nature, but out west, Western United States, it doesn't quite have that culture. It's changing because it has to, but it's not at the same level, and I don't think that people have kind of come to terms with the idea that, look, I'm using it, so I'm going to pay for it. Kind of like the national parks. It's like, okay, the federal government pays, taxpayers pay for it, but the people who use it the most, why shouldn't they pay a little extra because they're the ones who are actually taking full advantage of it?
So, well, an example of that, Michael, is, you know, down in Southern California, when the 405 is running through Orange County, there's a parallel toll road that runs right next. I don't remember the number of the toll road, but during rush hour, it can take you hours to get down that, creep down that 405. And people won't go spend the $2 or the $5 to ride on the toll road. And, I mean, they're burning far more than that, sitting there, you know, getting overheated in their cars. So it's just amazing this resistance people have to even spending a couple of bucks, you know.
And I think I know exactly the freeway you're talking about. I think I've been on that one and had to pay that toll. And and here in the Bay Area, where we operate from, we've got now these high occupancy lanes that you actually pay for. That you've got your device and it automatically will debit you. And you know, when you're in a hurry or things are really jammed up, it just makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about returns, because obviously investors are not in this just for charity. Or for utilitarian reasons. We've got an article that ran in our infrastructure magazine. We also ran it in Real Assets Advisor magazine. And again, Sheila wrote about the returns, and she quotes Cambridge Associates saying that the infrastructure funds that raised money in the years before the global financial crisis delivered a pooled net internal rate of return of 6.7% as of third quarter 2017. Now, that doesn't sound like a terrible return, but it fell pretty far short of what they were hoping for. 8% to 12% was the range they were hoping for. Considering that we're in a yield-starved environment, 6.7% doesn't sound that bad. You were going to say, Jeff?
Well, it's an apples to oranges comparison. It goes back to what we were talking about before. The funds that were put together before the global financial crisis basically took a private equity model and superimposed it on an income-oriented investment structure for infrastructure, and that didn't work out too well. The fees gobbled up way too much of the return, and the leverage that was employed to try to get a higher return out of those assets worked to their disadvantage during the global financial crisis. When you stop and think about the devastation that was wreaked on all real estate and infrastructure funds during that period of time, 6% sounds even better when you put it in that context. The programs that are generated that are in place today are generating better returns than that, but not much higher. I mean, look, infrastructure is a 6 to 10% returning investment on a current cash yield basis, depending on how you structure it, what sector you're going after, and how much leverage you use. So that's probably what it's going to deliver on a total return basis. You could get higher returns if you want to take more risk. You can get lower returns if you want to get more stable returns and lower risk. But that's generally what it delivers.
So let me ask you this. For several years running, I believe, it hasn't been continuous, but Toronto has been home to VIP infrastructure for a number of years. Tell me why Toronto?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is we thought it'd be nice to have a home base for it. Secondly, the Canadian funds have been doing infrastructure investing for about 2 to 3 times longer than U.S. investors have been, and they've got a lot of experience. And so it's an opportunity for U.S. investors and investors from Europe and Asia to come to Toronto and connect with those investors. And it's easier for those a greater number of those investors to attend our conference, since it's in so many of them are located either in Toronto or in Montreal. It's not such a big hike for them to get there.
I wanted some anecdotal information from you here, Jeff. Other than roads, which of course we drive every day, a lot of times people bring up airports as being either a show of pride or an embarrassment to a country, depending on whether or not they're in good shape or not. You do a lot of travel. So how often at a U.S. airport are you feeling that you're at an airport that is up to snuff versus undergrade?
Well, if you talk about the U.S. airports, the major ports, JFK, Chicago O'Hare, SFO, LAX, Dallas-Fort Worth, Dulles in Washington, D.C., Atlanta, there's lots of others, but I mean those are the biggest hub cities. Houston, all of them were built before the first terrorist on airplane X occurred, and so none of them were built to manage traffic the way it needs to be managed today. So everything that's been done to make those airports as modern as they possibly could has been done in a retrofitting fashion, because they really weren't designed to manage human traffic, foot traffic through the airport, the way that they're supposed to, the way they would design them if they built an airport from scratch. The only one that actually has been built after the terrorism event has been Denver-Stapleton, the new Denver-Stapleton. And it's probably one of the better airports in the country in terms of traffic flow and what have you. The other thing is to understand that airports have become regional malls. I mean, they're really, a lot of the revenue flow comes from, gate licensing, but a lot of it also comes from retailing. And so none of these airports were built for that either. And so, you know, they aren't as spiffy and nifty as some of the other ones. You go to Changi in Singapore, or you go to, you know, the airport in Hong Kong, or you go to Beijing, or you go to Shanghai. These are world-class airports. Seoul, I mean, they're just an amazing, you know, places to go travel. And the experience of being in those airports is a lot more positive and than it is in U.S. ports. And I talked about probably some of the best airports in America. When you go to places like Burbank or, you know, the little smaller hubs, they're really antiquated and horrible for all the reasons I talked about.
Mm. So let's finish by talking about what a lot of people are concerned about, which is the inevitable correction that we're going to have a recession coming up. When the recession does hit, and assuming it's a normal recession, not one of the devastating ones like we had most recently, infrastructure is well positioned to withstand that? Is it a good hedge against inflation and interest rates, Jeff, or is it going to take the lumps, the same lumps as anybody else?
Well, you know, it depends on the infrastructure, right? People aren't going to use that much less water during a recession. Industrial use will go down, right? But road use will go way down. So it just depends on what's going on. If you don't have as much commerce happening, you don't have as much trucking, you're not going to have as much road usage. And if people aren't feeling good about spending money, they're not going to be taking as many pleasure trips. So, you know, toll road usage and, you know, bridge usage and things of that nature will decline. It always does during a recession. That's goes without saying. Electrical use, industrial electrical use will go down as the industrial mechanism slows down. But, you know, certain usages aren't going to be as impacted. And that, you know, while you may not be hitting the targets that you'd like to be able to hit, if you're an owner of those assets, they're probably still going to generate sufficient cash flow to cover their debt service and generate a small return. So there'll be a downturn in the infrastructure business, but it shouldn't be disastrous. The other thing to understand is all of these assets are essential use assets. Even if you're not using the roads as much, we have to use roads. We have to transport ourselves. We have to transport goods. We have to transport services. We have to do all those things. And, you know, it'll be interesting also to take a look and see what happens during this next recession, whenever it occurs. Most people think it's 2 years out, but who knows? Because it'll be the first major recession where e-commerce is fully matured, or is matured as much as it is today. So it'll be interesting to see if part of what that does is drive more people to the internet, a lot less. Again, we don't know. We everything we're living in today, the environment in which we're living in, the economic environment, is different. We've never been here before. Some things about it are, you know, the human nature sides of it are the same. But, you know, technology really is having a huge impact on everything. And that's one of the things we talked about at the conference at length. That's one of the things we talked about at our editorial board meeting, the last time the editorial board met.
Which is, okay, technology having a huge impact. Did you want to be any more specific than that? Or are you just saying just generally, whether it's building, what is it, BIM, building information management, or just high-speed rail or what have you, or hyperloops like Elon Musk is talking about?
Driverless cars. I mean, exactly. You know, the automation of everything, even construction processes, you know, 3D manufacturing, which is now capable of manufacturing components that go into major building projects. I mean, there's all kinds of different things that are having an impact on this. And it's all moving so quickly that it's difficult for any of us to really get our arms around it. And one of the things that we talked about at all these conferences, we talked about it at BIP Real Estate, is that most people, you know, there's an awful lot of hype out there about technology, and it's really easy to get overwhelmed about it. What is a constant theme from speakers at our conferences is that most people tend to way overestimate and overhype the impact of technology in the short term and way underestimate its impact in the long run. And that's probably true for infrastructure as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And any of our listeners who are new to the infrastructure subject or just aren't aware that we have a publication called Institutional investing in infrastructure. All you have to do is go to our website, irei.com, click along the navigation bar near the top, you'll see infrastructure. And we write about infrastructure in a big way, both on a daily basis on the website, as well as in our magazines online and in print to some degree, in our real estate publications, even in Real Assets Advisor, our retail investing magazine.
I might add one more thing to that, Michael, which Please. Is that if you're a qualified investor, meaning you work for a pension fund, an endowment, a foundation, a sovereign wealth fund, a family office, a life company, a major commercial bank, or you know anybody that's deploying capital into the infrastructure sector, you can subscribe to this publication at no cost. It's a controlled circulation publication. If you're an investment manager or a consultant or somebody with just an interest, there's a minimal cost to subscribe to the publication. Basically, those costs cover a portion of our editorial costs and the print costs associated with the publication. Really encourage you, like you said, to go and check it out because it really is a wonderful resource for people. And it's the only infrastructure publication I know of in the world that's investor-focused.
And there you have it. And, you know, I mentioned one other thing, Jeff. We've talked a lot about the United States and infrastructure here, or North America for that matter, but the projections on the need for infrastructure globally is absolutely staggering. I think McKinsey & Company was talking about $17 trillion. When you think about the developing world, particularly in Asia, and the amount of infrastructure that's going to be required, the investment opportunities, although they're difficult in the United States, as you pointed out, maybe a little bit less so overseas, it's an enormous area of investment potential.
Yes, and I think that's the key word, Michael. You know, we talked about this at length at the meeting. There's a big difference between the investment potential. What is the need, dollar need for infrastructure, and investment opportunity? What are the deals that are available in the market? And there's a big gap between those right now. It would be nice if there's $17 trillion worth of opportunity, right? Because then the investment capital isn't equal to the opportunity, and therefore the investment capital would have some leverage. But the reality of it is there's plenty of investment capital and very few deals, and that's the problem right now. Mm-hmm. So, and that has to come, you know, that will only change with, you know, government policy and public awareness. Because the public is basically one of the things that puts a drag on the development of opportunities for these things. Because they're uneducated. They don't understand that, you know, they're cutting off the nose to spite their face when they're opposing these projects.